Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
The essence of America, what really unites us, it is an idea that you can come from humble circumstances and you can do great things.
This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We are the free and unconquerable people of the United States of America.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
The story of America is one of people who have made their dreams come true by realizing that the time for action is always now.
This hour, Julissa Arce. Her perspective on what it means to be an American is informed by a childhood in the United States as an undocumented immigrant. You'll hear what that meant as Julissa excelled in high school and began looking for colleges, what it was like to be recruited at Goldman Sachs, frightened they'd discover her fake green card, and what happened on the summer morning in 2014 that she took the oath and became a legal citizen of the United States. I started my conversation with Julissa with a phrase that I've asked all of my guests in the series to consider. It comes from the Langston Hughes poem, Let America Be America Again. In the second stanza of the poem, Hughes writes, "Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed." Can you tell me what that says to you?
Yeah, you know, I think I look at the rest of the poem to really come up with the answer and to see what those two lines really mean. And you know, what he's saying in the poem is that the idea of America isn't an idea that has ever applied to him. And in a lot of ways, I feel the same. I feel like my entire life I was pursuing a dream that wasn't really made for me. And yet, somehow, I was still able to navigate through these systems and make something out of it. And when he says to let America be America again, he's saying, and I'm saying, let America be the America that it was intended to be. And we're not there yet. America is not what it's supposed to be for everybody. Some people have access to this American dream and some people don't. And some people, no matter how hard they work and how much of themselves they give to their dreams, will still not be able to attain it. For me, you know, when I think about the people that that applies to is the undocumented people who, no matter what they do, no matter how much they accomplish, no matter how much they work, they're still not part of what defines America. They're still not part of the fabric of our country. They have to live in the shadows and they have to live in fear, and there's nothing they can do to fix their situation. There was nothing I could do.
Do you think, I'm going to come back to what you said about you were pursuing a dream that wasn't really made for you, but I wonder if you think America represented a kind of dream for your parents as they thought about leaving Mexico and staying here and all of the risks that entailed. I mean, what do you think that dream was for them?
Yeah, I mean, my parents saw America through rose-colored lenses. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this in my book a lot. I talk about this in my book, just the difference of how I saw America and the way my parents saw America. And for them, the American dream meant having access to opportunities that they didn't have access to back home. And for their daughter and for their children to have a better life and to have access to opportunities that they didn't have access to when they were living in Mexico and that they didn't think we would have if we stayed in Mexico.
What I think is important to understand is when we talk about that dream and that idealism that you mentioned that your parents held about America, it's not just economic, right? It's not just I'll be able to work the kinds of jobs that will bring the kind of money that will let me do the things I want to do. America's much more to that, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, for my mom specifically, you know, she always told me since I was very little that, like, education is everything and that she wished she would have had an education. And she didn't, to her, America was about having equality. It was about being seen the same way that my dad was seen, for example. And it's not something that she felt like she could achieve at home. So for her, America was this land of opportunity and this land where people are treated equally. And you know, she really believed in America. I mean, I tell this story in my book where she literally would say, like, even bacon was better in America. I mean, that's how much she loves this country. You know, she thinks everything is better here.
Your parents had been, they were both born and raised in Mexico. Is that right?
Yes.
They had been coming into Texas from Mexico to sell jewelry and other items. And what, they had the documentation to do that. Do you remember what they told you on the day that they decided that the family was just going to stay in Texas and not go home to Mexico?
You know, I was getting into a lot of trouble back home. At that point, I was living with my grandmother, and I was seeing my parents maybe once or twice a year. And I didn't know that I was coming to live in the U.S. until I was already here, because I used to spend the summers here. I had a tourist visa, and so I used to come spend the summers with my parents. And it was a very different American than I saw as a tourist, right? It was like trips to McDonald's and Chicken McNuggets and Six Flags and SeaWorld before I saw Blackfish. So my parents didn't really have a conversation with me about you're coming to live in America. It was more like me asking them, when am I going back to Mexico? Like, school's going to start soon. When am I going back? And then that's when my mom told me, you're not going back. You're going to stay here and you're going to go to school here. And it wasn't news that I was expecting or news that I was thrilled about.
What was it like?
It was tough. It was really tough because on a number of different levels, number one, my parents, for the most part, were somewhat strangers to me, right? They weren't really parents in the sense of I only saw them a few times a year since I was 3 years old. So I didn't know how to have parents in a way. And the language was difficult. Learning how to speak English was challenging. And culturally, the kids at school were different than me. And even though there were kids who looked like me, there's a large Hispanic population in San Antonio and Mexican specifically. It still was different. They were different. Kids can be mean, and you know, I used to get bullied a lot for the lunch that I would bring to school and for my hair being long. And now I think, like, you know, everybody wants to have long hair and everybody gets extensions. Mm-hmm. But back in the sixth grade, kids would make fun of me for having really long hair, and it was tough. It's a really tough transition.
Was it a secret? I mean, did your parents tell you, don't talk about where we're from, don't talk about what's happened, just act like we've always been here?
So, you know, when I first came to live in the U.S., my visa was valid, and so mm-hmm. I didn't, and also I was 11, right? So I never really stopped to think about, do I have the right paperwork to be here? I mean, I was a kid. The conversation really came when my visa expired. And that's when I was wanting to ask my parents, like, when am I going back to Mexico? I miss my grandma. I miss my sisters. I want to go to Mexico. And after a lot of conversations, it's when my mom told me, you can't go back to Mexico because your visa's expired. And in the book, I tell the, you know, the kind of the biggest reason why I wanted to go back to Mexico when I was 14. And the conversation that I had with my mother, and how much that conversation hurt without me realizing that she had actually said something to me that was much bigger, which was, you are undocumented now and you don't have papers. And that's really when my life in the shadows and my life sort of playing cat and mouse began.
Is that how you thought of it? That you were living on borrowed time, that it would only be a matter of time before somebody would find you and find out that you weren't supposed to be here?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the clock started ticking, right? The clock started ticking, and I was 14. I mean, I was a kid. At 14 years old, I didn't quite understand the consequences of this secret my mom had just shared with me. I couldn't have imagined.
When do you think you began to understand just what that meant?
I mean, the first time that I realized that being undocumented was going to be a really big problem, and it was almost going to be like living in a maze where I was always going to be hitting dead ends and I was going to have to go back and figure out some other way, was when I was applying to college. And you know, I was a really good student. I graduated in the top 5% of my high school class. And yet every single letter that I received from colleges I applied to was a rejection letter. And it wasn't because my grades weren't good enough or because my SAT scores weren't high enough or because I wasn't involved in school. It was because I was lacking a 9-digit social security number. And that 9-digit number was keeping me from pursuing a higher education that I had worked really hard to earn.
You've said that your mother looked at America as, quote, a stranger's house. We were guests. We had to be on our best behavior and be thankful for anything we got. And given what you just said about that, I'd worked really hard in high school. I'd earned the grades. You know, I think you felt like you were deserving of a college education. So how did that sense of I'm entitled to go to college meet up with your mother's kind of just be grateful that we're here and don't draw any attention to yourself?
Yeah. So I don't think I felt entitled. I didn't feel like
I think in the best sense of the word, though, Julissa, no?
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think, you know, I felt like I had worked really hard and I had done all the things that I was supposed to do, that my teachers had told me I needed to do, that my mom and my dad had told me I needed to do. I had checked all the boxes. So I kind of felt a little bit lied to. I think that's the first time I realized that that this American dream isn't something that is accessible to everybody, because you can do all the things that you're required to do and still not be able to reach it. It was like a moving target. And you know, I think in that sense, and I think maybe, you know, that happens with more generations, like as generations go by. Like my mom, as you said, like, you know, that quote that you said from my book, she very much felt thankful to be here and like she couldn't demand more. Where I sort of felt like I'm allowed to demand more. I'm allowed to question things. Like I'm allowed to be mad when I see injustice. And that's how I felt when I was applying to college and I was getting rejected. I felt like this is an injustice.
You know, I wonder if that's a common experience in between a first and a second generation family of immigrants, because you know, the parents do a lot of the sacrificing and feel mm-hmm. a lot of that gratitude for grabbing on and holding on. And then their children say, but I'm here and I'm playing the game as I'm supposed to. Why shouldn't I be entitled to a lot of the rewards that come with that?
Right. Because I think you also, you know, I started feeling like I was American, right? Like I had been here since I was 11 and now I'm 18 years old. So I've lived almost half of my life in America and a really critical years of my life in America. And so I think the difference was my mom always felt like she was, you know, as I say in the book, in a stranger's house, in a strange land that wasn't really hers, where I felt like this is my home. America is my home. And that just that small difference in the way that you think about a place, it really changes your perception and your thinking about it, right? So for me it was this is my home, and And I'm giving of myself to this home, and I care about this place, and this is the place where I want to live and where I want to live the rest of my life. And and I think a lot of immigrant parents, a lot of times their big dream is to eventually go back to their homeland.
Yeah, right. Was that your parents' dream?
I think that was more my dad's dream. My dad always wanted to go back to Mexico, and he just wanted to have a house with a big farm and have a mechanic shop, and that was my dad's dream. My mom would love to live here. My mom would love to be here always. She loves this
place.
And
still.
Yeah. I mean, she really wants to come back. But it's, even though I'm an American citizen now, we still can't get her here.
You said a few minutes ago that you were pursuing a dream that wasn't really made for you. What does that mean?
It means that the sort of the economic mobility, moving up the economic ladder, the next generation doing better than the generation before. You work hard, you reap the rewards of your labor. Like all of the things that I associate with the American dream aren't the systems that are in place don't allow for someone like myself to really achieve that dream. Right? And I mean, the reason why my story has received so much attention and the reason why it's made the news is because it's not common ground. Right? It's not That's like right. every day you hear of an undocumented immigrant who went from selling funnel cakes to becoming a vice president at the most powerful financial firm in the world.
Goldman Sachs.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, and that's why that's the same reason why when a kid who grew up in the projects and it goes to Harvard, like that makes the news because that's not common ground. And I hope that one day we get to a place where that doesn't make the news anymore because it's just so common.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you think that says about being an American that we find it so exceptional? Says a lot, it sounds like, that you can move on the path that you moved on, or as in your example, be a kid from the projects and make it to, to being the leader of the country or to working in a very high-powered job. What's that say about us?
I mean, I think you can look at that two ways. And on one hand, that's the amazing thing about America, that is possible. Right, that can happen, where in many places of the world, that wouldn't never happen. So on one hand, I think it says a lot of really great things about America, and I believe in the American dream, and I love this place. And on the other hand, the reason why it makes the news is because not every kid in this country has access to the same opportunities. The starting line for all of us is not the same. Some people are born on third base and some people are not. And that's why, I do the work I do now, because I want to help level the playing field so that every kid does have access to it. I want my kids to believe that this country belongs to them, because it does.
History books got it all wrong, so I come to you with a song. In 1810, con el gran grito de pasión, se levantaron con razón. Black and brown fighting together on a day I'll always remember. Because my ability to breathe is directly connected to my ability to see. It's not about me, never was, never will be. It's about we. It's time to move, y'all. It's movement time.
You're listening to part of our series called What It Means to Be an American. I'm Carrie Miller, and I'm having a conversation with Julissa Arce. She is an activist, a former executive at Goldman Sachs, began her life in the United States as an undocumented. Well, she had a visa. She was legal. But then her visa expired, and she spent quite a few years here as an undocumented American. She's written a book about that, having a conversation with me this morning about that experience and how that informs her idea of what it means to be an American. As you were recruited for Goldman Sachs, just as I read the background of this part of your life, you know, it sounded to me like this felt at the time like your life was really falling into place, and that maybe you thought that having that kind of money and having that kind of prestige would insulate you from, you know, the insecurities that you'd lived with, I guess both financially and emotionally. I'm interested in how you think about that.
Yeah, you know, I had this idea that if I could just become really financially and professionally successful, that it wouldn't matter that I was undocumented, that I could prove to people who didn't think I should be here that in fact I did belong here because I earned my way, right? Like I work so hard and look how much I'm. How much I've achieved, and maybe that would make me like worthy of being an American, you know, that's where my sort of dream of going to go work on Wall Street began, and of course, you know, once I was there, it wasn't quite like that. Like it was still, the fear is just kind of exacerbated because. It's sort of interesting that the higher I climbed up the corporate ladder, the bigger the fall would have been. And so the fear was just that much more. Like every day it was just an increased amount of fear and anxiety over what if I get caught and what if this is all over? And, you know, that's why I titled my book My Underground American Dream. Because this dream and everything I did was sort of on the underground. It was in the shadows. It really was like being in a maze and hitting a lot of walls.
Is it true that while you were on Wall Street that you would dream about what it was like, what it could be like to be caught?
Yeah, I used to have this recurring nightmare where I would walk into the office and nobody would say anything. Like I would just be led into an office and I knew what was next. And then I would wake up before my boss had the chance to like say what I knew he was going to say. Unfortunately, that's the reality that millions of people live in every day today, right now. Right now, someone is terrified as they're taking their kid to school that they might get picked up by immigration and not make it home to see their kid. Like that's the everyday reality that millions of people live in.
You know, I noticed that you use that word worthy of being an American, and I know what that meant to you then is probably different from how you think about it today. What does that word mean to you?
Yeah, you know, I've wrestled with that quite a bit recently because I think about all the horrible things that have been said about immigrants in the last year, and I think, you know, you have all these people that say, "Well, I'm American because I was born here," and yet, like in their everyday life, they're not thinking every day, what am I doing to earn being an American? And that's why when you were saying entitled, you know, that word to me is like, I tend to think of like, you know, like those people who like, they do feel entitled to everything just because they were born here. And I think that's just lucky. Like, you know, nobody chooses where they are born. Nobody chooses what kind of situation they are born into. That's just the draw of the luck. Like that's just you're blessed. You're blessed to have been born in this country. So, like, what are you doing to be worthy of it?
You asked in an online post not too long ago, What about Latinos, many of whom were born in America, that didn't go to college, that labor every single day, but no matter how hard they work, they still can't make ends meet? Does America not belong to them? What else would you say about that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's exactly what I think about. I mean, like, I think about the you know, like Texas and California and Arizona, and I mean, all of these places were Mexico, and so for like a lot of Latinos, the border crossed them. They've never moved. You know, especially like Texas. I think about my home state of Texas, and I have friends whose like family has been there for generations and generations and generations, and they were there when it was Mexico, and they were there when it was Texas, and they were there when it became the United States, and there's so many people that work so hard who were born here, and still somebody will look at them and still call them a wetback. Still somebody will look at them and you know, in places like Arizona, they can get pulled over. And in Alabama, they can get pulled over on suspicion that they might not have papers. And those are people who were born here.
I think
whose generations of families have been born here.
I think you're also tapping into perceptions around class. Right? I think if you live in a certain way, in a certain place in this country, there's a lot of assumptions made about you.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you've got the documents or not, those assumptions are still being made. But if you don't have the documents, more assumptions get piled on top of that.
Yeah. In my book, I share a lot of stories about this, but One of the things that I say on the topic is just the fact that like these stereotypes that we associate with undocumented immigrants actually really helped me out.
Right? How so?
Because who was going to, like, there weren't raids on the trading floor at Goldman Sachs, right? Like, immigration wasn't coming through asking people for their papers there, right? Like, it just wasn't ever going to happen. And I think about like some of the cleaning ladies at Goldman, and how there were comments made about maybe they're like illegal, and I'm sitting there being like, if you only knew, you know, like, and so nobody was ever gonna, and I wish, you know, I really wish that I would have really known that then, because I think it would have saved me so much anxiety and fear. But when I was living in it, I certainly didn't think of it this way, where now I can take a step back and say, nobody was going to question my papers. Nobody was going to question whether I belong there. Like, I graduated with honors from a top five business school in the country. And I'm now an associate at Goldman Sachs, and I talk a certain way and I dress a certain way. And who was going to question me? Nobody.
Why do you think you didn't understand that?
Because the fear. I mean, the fear is just so strong. And there were also just like everyday things that most of us take for granted, for me, were a lot more difficult. Just even going to a bar and getting a drink. Like, I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't have an ID. So the only thing I had was my Mexican passport that didn't have a visa anymore. And so just there are only so many times I could tell my colleague or my friend, like when they would ask, why are you using your passport? Like, there were only so many times I could say I lost my driver's license, right? So even things like just going to the bar and getting a drink were difficult. And that created a lot of anxiety for me.
I have to say, I can't imagine what it would be like to carry around a secret about my identity for so long. And I know people who don't feel like they can come out on their sexuality. I mean, I know there's a lot of reasons that people feel they have to hold back something true about their identity. But, I mean, that's the heart of you know, how you carry yourself in the world. And you couldn't do that for a long, long time.
Yeah, you know, and I think so much, I give talks all across the country now, and one of the most rewarding things for me is when at the end of my talk and at the end of my remarks, a young person will stand up and say, I am also undocumented. And the fact that we have created a space where a young person can stand up and say, I'm undocumented in front of hundreds of strangers is a beautiful thing, because they feel like they're safe to say that and they don't feel ashamed of being undocumented. Two things I cannot say for myself when I was undocumented. When I was undocumented, it was this really big source of shame almost. Like I was embarrassed by it. Like it wasn't something that I ever wanted anybody to know because of how they were going to associate the things they were going to associate with me, right? When you have television and we have the news telling you that that these people are pouring into the country and they're coming to take your jobs and we're coming to steal from you. Who wants to be associated with that? Even if you know that those things are false.
You know,
perception can be everything sometimes.
You've reminded me that. And this is one of the things that I'm talking with guests for this series about the mythology of America. But you've also reminded me that there is a, for the positive, shining side of that mythology, there's also a pretty negative mythology, which is if you weren't born here and you try to own this, this is what we believe about you.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to go that far, I think, you know, even when you think about just like different groups of people and what is being said about them now, right? When I think about like Muslim Americans and African Americans, like the images you see on television and the things that are associated with those groups of people. I tell a story in my book about just a really awful thing I experienced with a man I was dating who's African American and walking down the street and the awful things that someone yelled at him. And I thought, God, like he was born here. This man went to Harvard and he's being told these things. What can I expect?
You were undocumented until you married. Is that right?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that. Why do you laugh?
I laugh a little because I think, you know, I think about that. I mean, the irony of the situation really stings me because, you know, my mom like brought me here so I could be this like independent woman and not have to depend on a man. And so I could be anything I wanted to be. And then the only way I could fix my immigration status, like the only way, was through marriage.
This was not a marriage of convenience. You two were in love.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something like it bugs me when people like allude to the fact that maybe I just got married to fix my immigration status. And you know, life is complicated, and my relationship was complicated. It was, and for me it was. I don't know that I was ready to be married at 24 years old, but it was either we get married or like we're breaking up and no one will see each other again, because I was ready to go back to Mexico. Like it had gotten to a point where I just couldn't. I could no longer live the way I was living, and we got married, and you know, I'm always careful to say that it's not like every undocumented immigrant can just get married and magically become a citizen, because
do you feel like you have to say that?
You know, but I do, because I, you know, I think one of the biggest misconceptions is I get told all the time, like, why didn't you just make yourself legal? Why didn't you just go to the back of the line? Why didn't you just do it the right way? And the problem is that that line doesn't exist, and the right way, even even when there is that right way, it's not accessible to everyone. So a really big technicality in my situation was that I never crossed the border, right? I came here on a tourist visa, right, and that visa expired. Had I crossed the border illegally, even if I got married to a U.S. citizen, and even if I had children who are American citizens, I would still be undocumented. And I still would not be able to fix my immigration status under the current immigration system. Like, that's how broken the system is, right? That even if someone could be have the exact same story as me, but maybe their parent crossed them over when they were 2 years old. They don't have access to that. Someone recently sent me a message on Instagram and told me that he's been married to his wife for 15 years. They have 3 children who were born here. But because she did cross the border illegally, she can't fix her immigration status.
So she's going to live the rest of her life probably unless the immigration laws change.
I hope that we do really take a very good look at our immigration system and fix it. And when we talk about immigration reform, we're not saying magically make 11 million people documented. What we are saying is that the system is broken and it needs to be fixed.
What was different for you in the days after you married and now you knew I'm on the path to being a legal citizen?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of these things where, like, for 5 minutes I was, like, really happy and really thrilled and, like I could breathe a little. And then, you know, it was still a really long process. It was still, like, thousands and thousands of dollars and lawyer visits and having to navigate being out of the office so often when I couldn't tell my employer, like I couldn't tell my boss, like, oh, I'm going to this interview with immigration because I was already supposed to have home my papers. So it was still for a few years after that. And then, you know, I brought my little brother, came to live with us. I was finally able to bring back my brother, who he was born here, so he was a citizen. But even bringing him back was a bureaucratic process all of its own. Becoming his legal guardian, almost 24 years old, was so it was this thing where, like, I couldn't quite enjoy it yet because there was still this massive amount of paperwork and this really long, complicated process ahead of me. I think just now I'm and you know, there are things that still scare me, even though I know that I have a U.S. passport.
What still scares you?
It scares me that, well, a couple of things scare me. One is, I think one of the things that scares me is that by sharing my story, I'll create this narrative of, like, a good immigrant and a bad immigrant. And, like, why doesn't everybody just become vice president at a firm, right? Mm-hmm.
Because those are the immigrants we want, right?
Right,
the implication
exactly.
of that. Right,
exactly. And I never want to do that because, you know, when I think about the really critical, important jobs that immigrants do that make our country run, they deserve the same amount of dignity as I do and as anybody else does. So that scares me. The other thing is just, like, you know, a piece of paper doesn't define who I am. And for a long time it did. For a long time being undocumented was, like, the defining thing in my life, like the defining thing about me. And that doesn't go away by just having a passport. Like, there's a lot of emotional trauma that I have to deal with and overcome. It was incredible. I was at the White House yesterday for the Hispanic Heritage Month reception. And I'm walking around the White House. I took a picture with a portrait of of Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan, who's Republican president, who's the last president who passed amnesty. I'm just walking around, and there's a salsa band. So I start salsa dancing at the White House. And I just cannot, I mean, this literally just happened less than 12 hours ago. I was in Washington, D.C., shaking hands with the president. And I just can't believe it, because I think, I was undocumented for 15 years. I was scared to be in this country. And here I am shaking hands with the president. Like, I am the people. Like, I am American. And we have a long way to go. And he said that. He said that in his remarks yesterday, that we have a long way to go. We've made a lot of progress, but the job is not finished. And I feel a great responsibility to this country because of the opportunities it has given me to continue to make it better and to continue to make it a place that works for all of its citizens. All of us. It can't just be some of us, because when some of us are, I think about the Latino community and our purchasing power, for example, and the fact that one in four people under the age of 18 is Latino. One in four people under the age of 18 is Latino. So if we don't invest in the education of those kids, if we don't invest in their well-being, and we don't make sure that they have access to the opportunities that everybody else has access to, we are going to be hurting as a country. In 15, in 20, in 25 years, when all of those kids are adults and in the workplace, if they don't have the skills to be everything that they can be, that isn't just going to affect them. It's going to affect our entire nation. So selfishly, we should want everybody to do well and for everybody to have access to the same opportunities. I always think about the people that risk their lives to come here. I didn't have to do that, right? Like, I came here on a plane. But there are people who they believe in America so much that they're willing to risk their life, cross oceans, walk through deserts. And they do it because they want a better life for themselves and for their families. If they just wanted to get by, they would have stayed where they were.
Is there a musician that speaks to, what's at the heart of our conversation, what it means to be an American?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of musicians that do that. There's a band that I really like. They're called Las Cafeteras. And they sing renditions of, they have a lot of original music too, but they sing renditions of American classics, and they change the lyrics. Then they insert some Spanish into them and some Latin beats into the song. And I think it's so beautiful that we can do that, right? Like, it's so beautiful that the American culture is, like, I think the richest culture in the world, because it has so many flavors of so many cultures from around the world. This land was made for you and me.
Thank you.
Julissa Arce there on the question of what it means to be an American. You can hear all of our What It Means to Be an American conversations on my podcast, including Roseanne Cash and Luis Urrea.